Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. I am delighted to welcome author James McManus to the podcast today. James has experience for the Guardian newspaper as the one of the newspaper's Africa correspondents. Dates back to the period of decolonization in the 1970s through to the end of white rule in Rhodesia, which then became Zimbabwe. And James's new novel, Love in a Lost Land, features some of the kind of the experiences that he had covering this very turbulent piece of history. So we're going to talk a bit about the book and a lot about the period. Firstly, James, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much indeed.
Firstly, let's just talk a little bit about the book. Is this this isn't your first work of fiction, I'm guessing?
No, it's the eighth novel that I've written.
Okay. And it's related to your experiences in Southern Africa. Perhaps you can tell us a bit about the plot and a bit about the context as well.
Yeah. Well, the context is that I was the Guardian's Africa correspondent and was actually based in Paris when the Portuguese coup happened in 1974, April. Mm-hmm. That opened up the colonies of Angola, Mozambique and Guinea-Bissau to the liberation forces who were given independence by Portugal. And that immediately triggered all sorts of conflicts in Southern Africa, which was centered on Rhodesia.
Right.
Rhodesia then was, as I think we all know, a rebel regime, widely regarded as racist. And it was to that country that I was sent by The Guardian in 1974 to report on the development of events.
Okay.
And that's the setting for this book.
Mm-hmm. And with the story of Rhodesia, Britain obviously throughout the 1960s was going through a process of the decolonization of its African colonies. But obviously Rhodesia is one of Britain's African colonies where there was white minority rule. In places like obviously Ghana, that's not the case, but in Rhodesia it is. And so decolonization for Labour and Conservative governments becomes more complicated. Perhaps for those that don't know the story, you can give us a sort of an overview of what actually happened.
Yeah. The crucial aspect of Rhodesian history is that in 1923, it was granted the status of self-governing colony, mm-hmm. within the British Empire. And from that moment onwards, the small white minority there had political control. And this they exercised to build up the country and to do so in cooperation with the African majority. When I say in cooperation with, what I mean is there was an unseen and unspoken partnership created. The black African population, the vast majority, provided the workforce, the labor, and the white, small white population brought in the technology. Mm-hmm. And one shouldn't forget there was a huge technological shock had taken place in Africa as elsewhere with the arrival of the railways. So that was a situation which prevailed throughout the Second World War until the early 50s, when a new generation of young Africans were coming out of universities in Southern Africa and began to form a liberation movement to do what had been done elsewhere in Africa to get independence based on majority rule. So that's the situation that prevailed in the 60s when the small white minority regime in what was then Salisbury declared unilateral independence and mm-hmm. broke away from. That was the background to the country that I found in April 74.
Sure. And the white minority openly define the British government.
They did.
And you find a particular character, Ian Smith, who I think we'll discuss a bit more in a moment, with the governments of Wilson and Heath become essentially the bane of their existence. And all of a sudden, the process of decolonization becomes an awful lot more kind of complex, really. Tell us about Ian Smith as a character. Who was he?
I once interviewed Ian Smith. He was a farmer, a Rhodesian farmer. He'd been a World War II fighter pilot, a Spitfire pilot. He was a man of very limited intellect. I wouldn't call him stupid, but I think he operated within a very sort of tight range of opinion. And he was extremely right-wing. He believed, as he said repeatedly in public, that majority African rule should not prevail for 1,000 years, and so on and so forth. When he broke away from Britain, or his party did, the Rhodesia Front, he left the government in London with an almost impossible sort of task, because immediately the British government ruled out any military response. Mm. It would have been very difficult, really impractical, to fight what was a very small and very loyal Rhodesian army, that is loyal to the concept of white rule. Mm.
What if anything, were his, obviously, you know, from the late 1940s onwards, an openly racist, white supremacist regime establishes itself in South Africa. I would imagine that there were sympathies between the white regime in Rhodesia and the apartheid regime in South Africa. Is that
true? Absolutely. No, there's no question. And the Rhodesian War, as it became known, could not have lasted throughout the 70s as it did for 6 long years without South African military support and support in breaking sanctions. And sanctions were crucial because this was the only weapon really open to the British government. And they applied sanctions on everything except for medical products and educational products. And yet it didn't work. It didn't work because there was South Africa behind Rhodesia, a huge country with its own huge apartheid problems, of course. And it was South Africa that allowed that colony, as it then still was technically, to survive for those years in the 70s.
What do you think? Sorry, one of the things I've always wondered is you have London saying, well, we want to grant Rhodesia or Zimbabwe, as it will become, independence, but within certain kind of conditions, and not the conditions of white minority rule. What was preventing the Heath and Wilson governments from just washing their hands of the whole thing, saying, you know, doing what they did essentially did with Palestine, and saying, you know, we're walking away.
There was huge pressure on. Well, let me answer that very quickly. There was huge pressure on the government in London, whether it was Labour or Conservative, from African states and from the United Nations, and equally from America, which wanted to see the end of this. America's situation, of course, was cynical, because Rhodesia produced, amongst other minerals, chrome, and right. America needed that chrome. It was a major supplier. And therefore, the Senate passed a legislation allowing the Americans to trade with Rhodesian chrome, or in Rhodesian chrome, despite sanctions. And that was one of the many sort of moral complexities of the situation. And if I can just point this out, nothing is totally simple when one looks back at the Rhodesian conflict.
No.
Because with 6 million African population and with 250,000 whites, it was quite clear that if the African population had simply stopped work for a week, for instance, the regime would crumble. They were utterly dependent upon African labor in a whole range of different sort of areas. And what is more, the Africans took a sizable sort of role in the security forces of Rhodesia.
Right.
There was the Rhodesian African Rifles, a regiment, a battalion which grew to 4 battalions by the end of the conflict. There were Africans in the police forces, in the special forces, and so on and so forth. Now, one has to ask oneself, what were they doing? Why were they not fighting for independence? And the answer to that question lies in the very troubled tribal nature of Rhodesia, with two large and separate tribes. And it was because of their age-old conflict that we see a lot of Africans, mostly from the Ndebele people, joining the Rhodesian security forces or the Rhodesian police. There were also other reasons for them to do so. A young African man given the chance to train with modern infantry weapons and so on and so forth, it was quite an attractive thing to do if you didn't actually feel that you were being represented by one of the liberation movements.
And there's always, I mean, the fact that people are reasonably well, or if not reasonably well, but regularly paid when they serve in armies, is often a thing that often gets overlooked.
Exactly.
And that can be, you know, whatever your politics, a powerful and attractive inducement in...
And it was. You're absolutely right to point that out. It's absolutely right.
Yeah.
They were well paid.
So the other kind of, you know, major character in this story is Robert Mugabe. And Mugabe's a curious character. Somebody who, in 1980, when Zimbabwe becomes an independent and a black majority rural state, to my knowledge, was generally quite well thought of, and who by the end of his rule is seen as a kind of a murdering tyrant. I suppose one of two things is possible: either Mugabe was this very fluid character, and it transformed into this arch reactionary over time, or people were tremendously naive about him in the first place. And what are your thoughts?
There's no easy answer to the character of Robert Mugabe. I first met him in December 1974, when he'd been released, as had the other nationalists, under the terms of an agreement by which supposedly peace talks were to start and the transfer of power would be negotiated. But of course, Ian Smith very quickly stepped away from that. But for a few brief days, Mugabe was there in Salisbury, as it then was called. I met him in his sister's house in Harare, the township. He was rubbing Vaseline into his legs. They had been very sort of dry, flaky from years in prison. And I spoke to him for about an hour, I suppose. He was a very cold, but intelligent, calculating character. He was trying to help me. I said that I'd heard he liked the poetry of T.S. Eliot because he'd done postal degrees while in prison with a South African university. And he said yes, but he wouldn't be drawn on which particular poems he liked of T.S. Eliot or whether there were other poets he liked. But he did quote me some of that verse so that I knew he wasn't telling any lies. And throughout the 70s, I saw Mugabe in various meetings of the Organization of African Unity while in exile up and down Africa, and indeed in Geneva when there was a conference on Rhodesia in 1977, I think. He was always the same. He gave nothing away. And it was very hard to find out who the man was behind what was a mask. Of course, it was.
And then, you know, you have this kind of this experience. I many years ago, as a reporter here in Wales, I met the kind of the white Zimbabwean diaspora, the people that had fled Zimbabwe after independence. And it was at a time in the early 2000s when there was a lot, Mugabe was invading white farms in this sort of very kind of brutal and violent way. And you saw these pictures of white farmers being beaten up and things like that. And so they were quite politically active in the UK, still getting a lot of sympathy. I went round to interview them, to one of the guys once who fled Zimbabwe. And all over his wall were kind of oil paintings of him and his mates with assault rifles in the bush, having waged this guerrilla war as well. And that was the moment where I thought, okay, well, I wonder who I'm talking to here. And so I guess the conflict in Rhodesia and then Zimbabwe produced both winners and losers, but with kind of many shades of grey, you know. But how did you find the particularly the white farmers who were eventually displaced? What was your sense of them?
These people were trapped in history, because what became very apparent to me in my early years in Rhodesia was that quite obviously the white population was going to lose. The numbers were against them. The world was against them. Even South Africa was beginning to lose faith, if you like, in the whole Rhodesian project, because South Africa had its own problems. It also wanted sort of to get some sort of relationship with the outside world, despite apartheid. And yet, when I put this to Rhodesian farmers, and I went around and saw a lot of them, particularly those in the operational areas where life was pretty dangerous, they just refused to see it. They thought they had built something which was worth fighting for. And to some extent, they had built up or were helped with the argument to build up a remarkable country. The technology, the farming, the roads, the infrastructure was all very, very, very good, way beyond anything else in Africa. But they had an emotional attachment to this country, which was partly the product of some, what you might call brainwashing, if you like, by the regime itself. And partly because there was a history there. That country had started with a flag planted in 1890 in the middle of the country. And they felt attached to the sort of pioneer spirit which had created the country.
Yes.
But it was a losing proposition. It was suicide. And when I discussed this with them, they just didn't get it. It always amazed me that intelligent people could actually think there was something worth fighting for down there.
Was there a sense amongst them that they saw a way of winning?
No, to be fair to them, by 1975, 76, no one ever thought there could be outright military victory.
Yeah.
What they were fighting for, and this did make more sense, was some sort of deal which could allow for power sharing.
Yeah.
Well, I did have to point out in conversations with these people that if you looked up and down Africa or anywhere else in the world, the concept of power sharing between two rival entities or tribes, if you like, or peoples, that never works.
No.
But that was their hope. That was what kept them fighting. The other reason I should explain is there's a sort of an emotional context here. If you've been fighting and some of your friends or family have been killed, you want to go on fighting for revenge. So there's that sort of element in it too.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah. And you find, I mean, there's a version of this in every instance of settler colonialism in the world. You know, you if you look even back at the way that sort of Germans viewed the kind of what they've viewed as the kind of the stolen lands in that were eventually part of Poland. You know, you have to go all the way back to sort of stories of the Teutonic Knights invading in various kind of Eastern Crusades, and viewing that as ours, and the people that happen to be on the land now, well, they're sort of an inconvenience, or you know, they haven't done very much with the land, or there was nobody here, or kind of some other sort of fiction. And everywhere you look, from kind of the Americas to kind of parts of Asia where there is white settler colonialism, Vietnam, for example, you find the kind of like a version of the thing you're talking about right there. And a sense that, you know, if you're a white settler colonialist who's actually been born in Africa, there were some years ago that I met some essentially white settler colonialists who were born in Kenya, and the first thing they referred to themselves as was Africans. And that's what they thought of themselves as. And you know, whether that's right or whether that's wrong, that's how they saw it. And
that's absolutely how the white Rhodesians saw themselves, as Africans. And some could trace their family back three generations to those pioneers that I mentioned who came up on horses and wagon carts from the south and established the colony in 1890.
I suppose it's a bit much for them to take lectures from, say, America on this sort of thing, you know. Of course, I suppose that the final figure in this story, if we go back in time, is actually Cecil Rhodes, who perhaps is responsible for most of what followed. I mean, obviously, Cecil Rhodes has been this figure of huge controversy in the last 10 to 15 years here in Britain, with sort of, you know, campaigns to remove his statue from various places, various universities. I mean, to what extent would you say that the conflicts that you saw were the sort of the product of him directly?
Well, that doesn't really apply to countries like Kenya, Tanzania, at all, because he didn't sort of reach that far.
Sure.
Rhodes was an old-fashioned Victorian imperialist who was doing no more than what we had done in India, if you like, trying to expand the British Empire. It's very hard for us now to look back and think of the British Empire as a sort of a viable context or viable concept, I should say, and or indeed a viable project, if you like, because inevitably it wasn't going to last. And it didn't take very high intelligence to see that.
Yeah.
But Rhodes put a huge building block in place in Southern Africa. And we shouldn't forget that when independence came, Mugabe was taken aside by Samora Machel in Mozambique, president of Mozambique, and by president of Nyerere in Tanzania, and told that he had inherited, quote, a jewel in Africa, and that he should keep the white farmers on the farms and keep the white infrastructure, but just change the political nature of the country. And Mugabe reluctantly did that.
Mm.
And the extraordinary thing about Mugabe was that not only did he keep white farmers on the farms, he employed Dennis Norman, the former white agricultural minister, in his own government, and he appointed other white officials in his administration.
Mm.
So he was open to the whole concept, if you like, of a white ruling class, but with the black politics on top.
Yeah.
That didn't last very long, of course, but that was what he did. And that was a recognition by those African leaders that what had been created in Rhodesia was quite exceptional in terms of Africa, and they wanted it to continue.
Yeah. And I guess that's the sort of the pragmatic way of looking at Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, not to, kill the goose that lays golden eggs. But of course, that is what Mugabe does. And I think it's worth pointing out that for every white farmer that was displaced or murdered by Mugabe, many, many more black Zimbabweans died. How do we sort of make sense of that? This kind of Zimbabwean nationalist leader who is guilty of killing far more Africans than he is Europeans.
Yes, that's a very good point. Well, the way I would put it is this. The Rhodesian war has never really ended. What has happened in Rhodesia by way of independence has not benefited the people of Zimbabwe. What's happened in Zimbabwe has not benefited the people, particularly the rural population. If you look at the situation now under President Mnangagwa, the vast majority of the rural population are worse off now than they were at independence.
Yeah.
If you haven't got foreign currency, it's very hard to buy so much as an aspirin in Zimbabwe now. And for all the dressing that goes around the regime and for all the PR and for all the propaganda, that is a fact.
Yeah.
Why did it happen? Why did this man Mugabe, who accepted the idea of using white technology and using white administration, what turned him, what went wrong? Because it went wrong very quickly, Nick. It was within 18 months that Mugabe unleashed the Korean-trained 5th Brigade on the Indibeli people in the southwest. That's because they were basically from a rival nationalist group. The group had never got on, the ZAPU and with the ZANU. And there was a fear amongst Mugabe's administration that there was going to be some sort of armed coup, armed rebellion down there. I don't think anyone believed that then, and it certainly isn't credible now. But what happened in that campaign, and this is 18 months for independence, was mass slaughter and mass rape on a really unimaginable scale. And that sort of built into the country at such a deep divide, it's still there today.
Right.
So when I say the Rhodesian war has never really ended, it certainly hasn't ended for the, or the consequences haven't ended for the people, the vast majority of the people in Zimbabwe. And that is nothing short of an absolute tragedy.
Yes. And when we look at that divide within the country, how would we best describe that? Is it a sectarian divide, an ethnic divide? These two completely different peoples and are hemmed into, is it a linguistic divide?
It is linguistic. It's purely tribal. I mean, that is what it is. And we shouldn't sort of try and pretend that is a situation common only to Africa. You can look at us and the Scots and us and the Welsh and us and the Irish in particular.
Yes.
And see, if you look at the history of the English and the Irish, it's a very violent and shameful history.
Yes.
So it's not as if this is purely an African trait, but it is certainly true.
The Flemish and the Walloons in Belgium.
Well, go on. Go on forever, yeah. But it's certainly true in Zimbabwe that the tribal divisions remain as strong today, really, as they were then.
Yes. I noticed when Mugabe passed away, and he was replaced, that there was a kind of a brief flurry of around kind of Western capitals and let us go and speak to the successor and kind of make nice with him. But and I say this from my limited knowledge, it seems as if there's a kind of a different person in charge, but sort of much the same kind of approach. Is that fair to say?
It certainly is. The corruption, the suppression of any dissent, the suppression of any political opposition has continued today under Mnangagwa, much as it was under Zimbabwe. And as I say, it's shameful. It's a tragedy. And it's one that African nations don't really recognize and certainly don't do anything to change.
And it has kind of enhanced the, I mean, for the kind of reactionary commentator who believes that, you know, the empire was a largely benign exercise and, you know, savage natives should be under the tutelage of white imperialists and that's what's best for them. That argument, and this is what I heard a lot of when I was engaging with white Zimbabwean emigres in the UK, that argument is greatly enhanced. You know, when we were in charge, we looked after, you know, we looked after them. But of course, that's not really true either, because obviously, you know, colonialism carried its own sort of burdens and impositions and hardships.
Of course it did. Yeah. Look, if you take a very short-term view, you can find people in Zimbabwe, and I still have contacts there, African people, who will tell you that they were much better off under Ian Smith than they are under Mugabe or Mnangagwa. That is certainly true in terms of access to medicine, education, and just, you know, a peaceful society. And it's equally true to say, and it's not something that an awful lot of people like to recognize, that race relations in the old Rhodesian era were way better than they were, for instance, in South Africa, where apartheid was an absolute sort of brutal regime.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was there, you could take Africans to dinner in hotels and so on and so forth and meet them quite openly all over the place. But that's a very short-term view. You're quite right. In the long term, there's absolutely no way. We have to sit back and recognize that white rule in Africa was, if you like, it's what's produced this situation. I'm not quite sure whether that's an accurate thing. But certainly in the long term, history will see Africa as having unshackled itself from imperial and colonial rule, but has yet to find a future. And when that happens, we just don't know. And how that happens, we just don't know.
No. And I guess one, you know, one of the, you know, to take a slightly different example and look at South Africa, say, you know, one of the great sort of disillusioning moments, I suppose, of the 21st century is to watch its this kind of decline of things like the ANC from being this sort of, you know, revolutionary liberation movement under Mandela to being a kind of a often widely disliked, corrupt and increasingly authoritarian party that is embroiled in all sorts of kind of unpleasant scandals. But perhaps that is the nature of what happens when revolutionary organizations establish themselves. There are numerous examples of it, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely. I just want to talk a little bit about the way that my book it tells a story of what I found there in the 70s.
Please do.
Because that's what we are
doing.
I was a correspondent based there for The Guardian in the 70s. And that experience was probably the most vivid of my life, if you like. Those six, 7 years I was in Africa, I was a young man in my 30s. And it stayed with me for all those years. This is 50 years ago we're talking about.
Yeah.
And I've always wanted to write about it and to somehow come to terms with what I saw there and the relationships I had there with people like Mugabe, Joshua Nkomo, and many other nationalists who I knew quite well because we met them all the time outside the country. And I've written this book, which is an awful, but it's very much based not just on what happened then, the kind of society I found then, but my own experiences in terms of personal relationships. And essentially, this book is about a love affair in a time of war. And it's an interracial love affair between a white magazine writer, aka, obviously, for anyone who reads the book, myself, and an African school teacher called Patience. And it's that affair in the context of war, which I think gives the book its dramatic appeal.
Yeah.
And it's emotional appeal, because that basically happened. And the story comes to an ending, which I don't want to give away to your listeners right now. But I think it's a book which will appeal well beyond those who know about the Rhodesia-Zimbabwe conflict, have feelings about Mugabe, or indeed Zimbabwe.
Well, interestingly, on a final note, not to kind of big you up out of all proportion, but I'm just reading one of the various biographies of Graham Greene at the moment. And I thought of you when I was when I was preparing this podcast, and I was reading his biography about how he took the kind of extraordinary things he was involved in and sort of humanized them into human stories. And I guess, you know, in a sense, that's what you're talking about here. And there's a I think Le Carré does that too, and brings the human heart into some pretty heartless stuff, if you will.
Yeah. Well, I will say immodestly, Nick, that you're not the first person who's mentioned Graham Greene in the context of this book, and I would be extremely flattered if that really was the case. But Graham Greene is one of my literary heroes, and I don't think I quite rise to his level. Or maybe I do, I don't know. That's my sort of modest judgment. However, I think the key thing about this book, Love in a Lost Land, is that it tells a story and it keeps the narrative flow throughout what was an extraordinarily sort of busy and violent time in Rhodesia.
Right.
And the birth of Zimbabwe is there. It's there in the book, painful though it was.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.